Hello and welcome to recording number 8 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. Today is September 8th, 2021. I'm going to restart on page 89. We've just been hearing a little argument going on between Eclavdra and Viron and Gratzt. Gratzt, of course, is the superior demon. He's king of the 333rd plane of the Abyss and has now conquered at least 8. In the various books, I've heard that number up to 24 and 36, so I'm not quite sure. But in this last book, it's supposedly 8. So I'm going to start with 8 as planes that Gratzt has control over. So Viron is a demon who has a much more kind of like a neutral aspect. He's not evil for evil's sake. It's more that Viron is has no morals and is willing to do whatever is expedient. But he's not like Gratzt and most of the other demons. So he's advising Gratzt not to go after this artifact, not to participate in the contest with Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy. And so Eclavdra, who is striving to replace Viron, she is coming up with all these challenges. Now, she is going to be the champion, and she hopes this is going to enhance her status. So right now, she's come up saying that Viron, Viron's advice is bad, that it's going to, that Uz and Yggdrasil are too strong for them, for Gratzt to do as Viron suggests. So we're going to begin right here on page 89, the third paragraph down from the top. My champion speaks well, Viron. Words are true. I must have the final key. And so I must agree to the contest Yggdrasil has decided upon. I do not forgive her, nor do I forget the slightest injury. I bide my time. Opportunity will come. What you must do now, Viron, is to assist in assuring my victory in the coming struggle. Thereafter, we will consider what course to take, and then you may again counsel as you choose. Now, give me your mind as I direct. Viron calmly bowed, accepting the order with no show of emotion. Yes, Lord, I think thus. Witch and Cambion will use all of their power to see that the weaker of the contestants gains the prize. Abmi will thus be favored. Then, once the dwarf has gained the final key, those two will have traps and snares ready to take him and relieve the fool of the Theopart, if possible. If they fail in that, they will allow Zuckmoy to have it. Nay, help her as if faithful to a bargain they have surely struck with her. If that occurs and Zuckmoy is deceived, she will assist in warfare against the Scarlet Brotherhood and their diabolical helpers. At such point, I cannot ascertain which faction will prevail, Zuckmoy or Yggdrasil and Uz. And actually gaining the initial key, there will be dissension between Witch and Cambion, between Zuckmoy and Zuzblox, that I know. Unless they fall to bickering immediately, my liege, they cannot fail to take the initial key, for they will wield the power of two parts against a single one. You are agitated, Viron, Gratzt said as he observed the albino demon closely. I am, my king. If two parts are played against one, I think that the powers will enmesh and draw the three into a whole. The statement just spoken made Eclavdra shudder. The dark elf concealed this and said, yet if my lord king has two of the keys, he need not fight for the third. Let the scarlet slaves of the hells piddle with it, all the more discomfiture for Yggdrasil and the wretched Cambion she bore. How do you propose that King Gratz gain two keys, Viron's question, as the challenge Yclavdra had been waiting for? Quite simply, Lord Viron, drow female replied, making the honorific seem somehow insulting through her inflection. I will gain the final key for my liege. Then Yggdrasil and Uz will need to beg his aid in getting the one held by the Brotherhood, ostensibly for the horrid Zuckmoy, but of course actually for themselves. Possession of the final key will free my lord king from the confines of this plane, dupe or to take by force from the two that which they hold, will be a slight matter for one so powerful as King Gratz. Excellent, Gratz cackled. He placed his massive six-fingered hand on Yclavdra's silver-haired head and said, I commend you, champion. Succeed, and I shall elevate you to my nobility, and accord you status as first concubine as well. My liege is too generous. Huron, seeing that his words would no longer fall upon hearing ears, turned to practical matters. How may I assist in assuring the victory falls to your champion, lord? Gratz didn't seem to notice how Viron avoided giving any honor to Yclavdra, but the dark elven high priestess did. Another cause, she thought, for which I shall exact full payment from this pale worm when my time comes. Instead of showing her anger at the slight, however, Yclavdra smiled most charmingly at Viron, making sure that Gratz saw her display. Then she said, Yes, wise Lord Stord, please give me the benefit of your thinking. All that assists me in succeeding as champion only helps us all the better to serve our king. Again Gratz beamed. The albino demon barely raised a snow-white eyebrow at the spectacle. I will meditate, and study the whole matter constantly, my liege, so as to prepare to intelligence your champion when she departs. Will that be soon? Without waiting for a reply, Viron added, I also have at hand certain things which she will find helpful when venturing forth on earth. From my own store I offer cusps, shields to protect her eyes from the burning radiation of the sun. As he said this, Viron closed both his eyes tight for a second, as he felt the very brightness he spoke of. All right, break. So here we have some commentary. It's commented that here we're seeing Gratz as he does seem smarter and more capable than Yggdrasil and Uz and Zuckmoy, because he is willing at first, at least, to listen to from Viron, who is from a different viewpoint from Yclavdra. Now, he also shows, how he is he is a little more dumb than Viron, because he is, again, susceptible to this flattery from, the flattery from Yclavdra, which is really, Viron is offering him good advice. And Viron is, of course, looking at the end game. He's looking that if anybody is going to use these artifacts against each other, then you're really running the risk of joining them together. Now, one of the things he hasn't said is that I would think that even using one artifact against another artifact might draw those two artifacts together. So that if they even use the second against the first, or first against the second, I think that you are going to have this attraction, and that who, you know, without meaning to, I think you're going to join the artifacts. And I don't know, now they were separated at one point, but I don't know if you're going to be able to separate them now. I'm sorry for one second here. Neighbors. Anyway, I think we get here again that I lose respect for Gratz when I see him, you know, coming to disagreement with Ecclavdra. Now, the other thing at the end is that besides, you know, his desire to have Ecclavdra as his concubine, it's also, we note that then get that Viron, like Ecclavdra, also has some kind of, you know, the fear of the bright light. Now, it's mentioned that Gratz's plane is incredibly a dark plane. It's very unlighted. It does supposedly have a sky that is like a turmoil of flame, but it is not giving the light like our sun does. So there's some information there about the 330 level of the abyss where Gratz is trapped, and also about Viron not being able to handle direct sunlight without it hurting his eyes. All right. I am going to restart here, and it is page 91 and the fourth paragraph down from the top. "What else, Lord Stord?" Grazd asked with a tone that conveyed his dissatisfaction with so paltry a provision. Ecclavdra was quite pleased at that, although she too thought more must be given, for the contest was no easy matter, and her victory was by no means assured, despite her boasts. Let this Viron provide more means for her to displace him. "There is more, of course, King Gratz," the Albina Steward said with a ring of hurt in his voice. "Oh, please tell me what, noble Viron," Ecclavdra said with pleading in her tone, casting a look of anxious need toward the albino demon. Viron saw Gratz's expression as well as that of the High Priestess. "Amongst the many ideas I have are protections, weapons, and more. I beg my liege lord's pardon, not detailing each at this time. You have charged me with my best efforts, and I crave a bit more time to deliver to you to your ultimate satisfaction." "Be certain you do deliver," Grast admonished in his deep commanding voice. "You have our permission to leave us now, Steward. Report to us daily on your progress. It will not do to delay the departure of Ecclavdra much longer." The snow-skinned demon left the private chamber with dignity as Grass turned his attention to the dark elf. She had launched into an explanation of her plans to emerge victorious in the coming contest, and the demon king was listening to her speech with pleasure. The king's daily checks with Viron produced no results, and the monarch grew more and more agitated. Many days later, Gratz angrily summoned Viron to another audience in the shielded little place. "This delay is unconscionable, Steward," the black demon thundered. "Explain yourself to us, or there will be punishment meted out." "It please your abyssal majesty," the Lord Steward intoned formally to Gratz as he bowed from the waist. Demon King nodded, but made no suggestion that Viron be seated. Ecclavdra observed the exchange from her own divan next to the royal one. After a short pause, Viron stood straight and spoke. "After great thought and most careful planning, my liege, I have just this day finished devising a plan which will meet your majesty's needs. It is very simple, yet very complex. In all, my lord king, it will give you the advantage over the others." "Advantage? What of surety?" Surety King Gratz must be bestowed by one far more powerful than I. The advantage of surprise, that of precaution, and those of special equipment I can offer, but no more. Alright, so break. There's a comment here. It's asking if the different participants in this, like, you know, Yggdrasil, Gratz, Zuckmoy, if they are aware of what ultimately the Theoparchs can do. Now, there's in the Scarlet Brotherhood, there is, as at the beginning of Artifact of Evil, the Scarlet Brotherhood High Priest was a priest of Tharizdun. And they feel that they will, after Tharizdun is awoken, that they would exist to serve Tharizdun and not be destroyed. Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy, they are so interested, I think, in the power they can gain that they're willing to take the risk of possessing all three parts, but still trying to hold them off from each other. And they firmly believe that they're going to be able to use two Theoparchs and one of their allies use the other without awakening Tharizdun or joining the Theoparchs. Now, Viron is the only one who is looking at the long game and really sees, what is going on. While Gratz himself, he is thinking of holding two of the Theoparchs. And right now is thinking that maybe he won't, but who's to say once he has two, his lust for power isn't going to override his sense about the Theoparchs. Now, it's said here we're talking about emotional intelligence, rather, because these are supposed to be super geniuses. And they show different intelligence. Many people who have great intelligence do not have great wisdom, or at the very least, not great control over their emotions. So we see that even while they're very intelligent, they can be very naive in some respects. And, if you want an equivalency, take a look about how they do that Big Bang Theory, where they have four individuals who are all supposed to be in the genius level, and yet they're mostly emotionally stunted. They make bizarre decisions. The lead character is not only emotionally stunted, he is, he would probably be called within the autistic spectrum, so having some great intelligence, but at the same time severe, emotional and social, retardation, so that he's not able to deal. And so you have Uz, who acts like a child, Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy, who are unwilling, I think, to face, up to where the end result's going to be, and Gratz still susceptible to flattery that is, really, he knows Viron, and he's willing to accept this drow who is just charming him. So we're really getting this sense that, Gygax wanted to add an ability called comeliness for physical attraction and charisma for charm. And so that it wasn't a question of beauty, comeliness would have been. And I think we can see here that really there needs to be something about ability that relates to naivete. And it really does show that these incredibly powerful beings definitely are not looking ahead. Now, the Scarlet Brotherhood is looking ahead. They want to awaken Tharizdun, so they may be completely wrong about what will happen to them, but their belief is that if they worship Tharizdun, and if they awaken him, they're either not worrying about being killed, You know, they're subsuming their own survival value with that of Tharaston, and present him as greater than them, or they believe, rightly or wrongly, that they're going to survive the awakening of Tharaston. So they're not, they may be foolish, but they're not denying the end result. Whereas everybody else, including Gratz, seems to be completely disregarding what the end result would be if Tharaston took what was awoken. All right. So I am on page 92. It is the second paragraph from the end. Instead of flying into a rage, as he seemed about to do, Gratz glared at the albino demon for a moment. Then he relaxed and smiled. Your words, Vuron, bring sense into my mind as usual. You take your meaning and appreciate it. Relate your plan. Clavdra will, well cloaked and protected, will depart from the free city of Divers. There is a temple of yours, Lord King, in that city, and it will be possible to transport your high priestess to the catacombs beneath that place without arousing undue suspicion. Even the risk to her is slight. For those who opposed you are not concerned, Garden Lord, with your leaving your plane. All right, break. That's an interesting little revelation. I did not, I never noted before that there was a temple Gratz in Divers. From the context, it seems almost like it's an open temple, but that seems to go against what I believed I knew about Divers, that they would have a demonic temple openly in their city. I would suspect it might be a hidden temple. But that also gives you some information about an adventure idea, so what's going on in Divers. Because there has to be something that is either openly evil or hiding the evil of Gratz in the city of Divers. I'm going to restart. It's page 93 and the second paragraph. Gratz scowled at this, and Eclavdra openly sneered. That will put me many days behind that toad, Obmi, she snapped. Spies report that he rode from Molag a week ago. Ignoring her outburst, Vuron went on calmly. Thither will be an escort of half-drow able to tolerate the sunlight. They will be exposed to for so long a period of time as the journey will take. The lieutenants will be two able cavaliers, with high skill in the art of dioma crafting. The six additional guards will be half-drow also, an assassin of dire prowess, a thief with fighting skill, and four with only warrior training, but bounty nonetheless. All right, that I'm going to break here, because, so we're getting a half-drow. Now, what is a little different about Gygax's campaign is the drow are not unknown. Back when Gord was being Black Cat in Saga of Old City, at the very beginning of these stories, Gygax mentioned that nobody knew who Black Cat was, but it was rumored that he was a drow thief. So that the rumors going around the city of Greyhawk were of a drow. Now, I've kind of worked out the time. At that time, Gord is about 20 years old. They don't give a common year date. They don't give any dates whatsoever. But Yggville frees Zuckmoy at a time when the temple has been destroyed and Zuckmoy has not been freed yet. So it is probably about the start of the Temple of Elemental Evil module, which would put that at 576. And Gord at that time is about 28 years old. So if Gord is 28 in 576, we're looking at his birth about, 548. And then this business with the drow at about 568. And the business with the GD modules by the Giants' invasion of Geoff somewhere, I believe, after 576. So in this campaign, they already know about the drow. So, you know, it is very interesting to see then that he's really taken off in a different, Gygax has taken off in a different direction than, than was commonly with the advancing of the timeline. But if you remember from the 576 folio and 83 box set, the Giants had not yet invaded Geoff. So that kind of goes, it does kind of go, but at that time it was supposedly that the drow were unknown to most people. And here it really seems that in 560 CY, the inhabitants of the city of Greyhawk, it was common knowledge about the drow. All right. So, here we have two half-drow cavaliers who are also magic users. Now, I never really used a cavalier myself, but I thought they were an offshoot of paladin. So here we have an evil cavalier who also is dual classed. Now, these are drow, these are elves. So I believe the dual casting in first edition for the elves was fine. So they would be cavalier magic users. And fighter magic users was always a classic elven dual class. So, but it makes them very formidable, a combination of a heavily armored fighting cavalier there. We still have the assassin. This is very good. Chris has found the half-drow example from Polyhedron 30, circa 1987. I'm not sure, wonder if it mentions anything about Greyhawk back then, or whether they were already trying to generalize things to use in any campaign.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's Greyhawk specific.
Yeah. And in Polyhedron, it might not be. You know, Polyhedron was a rather dismal little magazine, but it did try to push some things. You know, and every once in a while, at the very beginning, you actually got modules in it. You know, there were actually fantasy modules back in the early Polyhedrons. I think they were finishing up that kind of thing by issue 30, though. All right. So, we have a half-drow assassin, and then four fighters. And all this coming from divers, so it really does seem to show that all over the drow are known, and are not so surprising to find. All right, I am going to restart. It's page 93. And we're on paragraph 4. The rules Yggdrasil laid down allowed a full dozen to escort me. Yes, priestess, and others will later join the group. After the party reaches Ket, six of the strongest barbarian horsemen of the Yolites will enlist. These horsemen will meet you in Hlupalu at a secret rendezvous there. It will serve to further protect the expedition and guide it through the Yol and the barren plains to the Ashen Desert. So, I'm breaking right here because we've gotten quite a bit. Gygax was not allowed to use certain names, so he replaced them. So the Yolites are Ull, you know, ULL. Ahupalu is in Ket, it's the capital, it's Lopala. The barren plains are the dry steppes, or they're the desert between Ull and the mountains going into the Sea of Dust, and the Ashen Desert is the Sea of Dust, I guess, if I've got all that right. And we really do need to either detail or come up, discover a gourd Greyhawk substitution there. All right. And here we have, Chris has put up the Cavalier, constitutions of scores of 10 in intelligence and wisdom. Oh, must initially be of good alignment.
Yeah, that's the notable part, the alignment.
Yeah, I think that Gygax has done one of his NPC rules. I believe early on he said that none of these characteristics are, they're locked in for players, but they're not locked in, in his desire to control the game. They're locked in for players, but they're not locked in for NPCs. So you can always find an exception to the rule for an NPC. There wasn't much in the way of TSR organized play back then. So there was really little that Gygax saying things had to be one way were actually effective, because he really couldn't do anything except maybe say if you were bringing somebody into a TSR tournament, you couldn't bring in this, that would be an illegal character. It was much later on when that, the RPGA started doing organized play that they could enforce, they had something to enforce their rule system with and saying this is an illegal character. But I don't think that having the evil NPC Cavalier magic users here would be against what is covered by, Gygax has mentioned. It'd be a good thing to locate. I'd love to be able to just pull up the, the information where Gygax made various statements or things came out like that. All right. I am going to restart again. It is page 93, third paragraph from the end. "Nonsense," Graz said, standing in fury and pointing menacingly at his steward, "who counsel a sure loss. The group will be seen, watched, dogged, delayed, and thwarted. At best it will arrive well after Zuckmoy's jackal has gained the city out of mind and departed." "I know that, King Kratz," the albino demon replied without emotion. There was a moment of shocked silence. Then the towering grass began to advance toward Vuron with a terrible look in his eyes. The pale demon seemed paler, but he did not flinch. "But Eclavdra will not be in the group, my liege. That is the beauty of the whole plan." The demon king drew erect, rocked back on his heels, and stared at Vuron. Then he boomed forth a deep laugh. "I should have never doubted your cunning and duplicity, good Vuron. Say on." "The great cavern of the Drow Lord is open to Eclavdra's entrance by magical means. There we will send her. From there she shall go up into the world. There is an entrance to the underworld near Gastur, is there not?" The query was directed at the dark elf. When Grat's quizzical gaze followed that of the albino demon, Eclavdra nodded her head to confirm that there was such a place. "There, my king, her true escort will be waiting. Tough, obedient, camel-riding warriors of the barren plains, along with two rogues who have robbed the dead in the ashen desert beyond. One is a spell worker, the other a thief of highly resourceful sort. While our enemies watch the false Eclavdra and feel content to be well ahead of her, the real one will be delving into the city out of mind, gain the final key as your prize, my king." All right, break. So this is, so whatever Gastur is, the equivalent, or whether it is actually a name that is being used, it's unfamiliar to me. We can put a little dot there and say, here is an exit entrance into the Underdark, and probably very close to the Vault of the Drow. But I know people have worked out various entrances and such, and I don't know if they have the vault as being under the Baclunish areas. So I've heard of entrances coming up in various places. but not in this gas store. So that's definitely worth notation being put down there. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 94 in the second paragraph. How can there be two of me? Clavger asked with a carefully neutral tone. Surely a simulacrum will be detected. There you are correct, High Priestess of Gratst. And you are well away, safely within Homeworld's deep cavern. We will bring forth a clone. But a clone will be done away with before difficulty befalls you, Drow Priestess. When the enemy fails, I will see to it that your duplicate does not remain to dispute with you which has the right to exist. The plan is accepted, Lord Stord, said the Ebon Demon Prince. We are pleased. Durin smiled a small, careful smile. Thank you, Majesty. There is just a bit more. Make certain none recognize her. Your servant and champion, Eclabdra, will be given an oil of special Diomer. It will lighten her skin so as to make it no darker than that of the nomads of the steppes. The splendid armor and weapons of her people betray no aura. But in the radiation of the open sky, and without the rays of the cavern, metal becomes less. Another solution I have alchemically prepared will serve to stop the decaying process for weeks, if not months. She will make her journey armed with undetectable protections. The elixir will even protect cloth, so she may utilize drow clothing as well. Now I am truly delighted with you, Lord Vuron, my faithful advisor. Again a small smile played across the white features of the demon's narrow visage, a small expression of satisfaction that Eclabdra alone saw as he bowed humbly to Gratst at the compliment. Also, my lord, there are a few trantles which I have gathered for the use of your champion. A decanter which spills forth water when needed, a magical mask to allow your high priestess to breathe and move freely as if dust or water were air to the lungs, and an assortment of other items which might prove useful to her in fulfilling your command. What perils and hazards do you envision, Vuron? The Demon King asked, pulling his steward down to sit beside him on his royal couch. Vuron answered at length, with interjections coming frequently from Gratst. After some time, the black-skinned demon glanced up and noticed Eclavdra sitting petulantly, barely concealing her annoyance. You will depart tomorrow, Eclavdra. You will return to your chambers now and rest. I will see you on the morrow. There is much I would yet discuss this night with Vuron, and there is nothing you contribute to this discourse. Eclavdra was clever to hide her shame and fury. Bowing, she quickly obeyed King Grat's command and departed. Her triumph would come, and then Vuron would be crushed. Break, this is the end of chapter 5. Now, Gygax is really demonstrating how superior Vuron is. He does try to show that Vuron is still the weaker, maybe just physically, of the two. And even though he doesn't flinch at Grat's anger, he still, Gygax is saying, turns paler than his snow-white skin. So, you know, we have here the conflict between Vuron and Eclavdra. Now, Gygax recognizes what he did with the D-modules in that the drow weaponry decays in the sunlight and also being away from the radiation of the vault and the Underdark. So, you know, we have his protections that will make Eclavdra able to use that super powerful drow equipment. Now, it is interesting that he's got several incredibly powerful items there. But Vuron, I think you notice that there isn't a tremendous amount of offensive weaponry. There's a wonderful mask to breed dust and water. You know, there's a number of protections, but really most of the weapons are going to be her own. Just they're not going to decay. And yeah, you know, a Clavdra's weaponry is going to be incredibly powerful, as she is such an important part of the Drow society at this point. If we remember what they were saying in the previous book, that the Drow, they fell for the elemental evil, which supposedly was a scam. And what happened afterward is many of them turned to Gratzt. I think it was like 30 or 40% of the Drow now worship Gratzt. And so, drawn away from Loth, she is now the High Priestess of Gratzt. So she really is, you know, the big, not the biggest bulk of Drow society, but the big bulk of Drow society is worshiping in Clavdra. The various things, an oil to change her skin, that's very interesting. And this is the first we hear of a Clavdra's clone who becomes a little foreshadowing, who is an important character. It is a very interesting plan. And also, you know, he is thinking very duplicitously by having this slow process from divers to Ket of the more who are going to be going more obviously being, you know, the drows and the half drows, and hopefully they're going to be slaughtered. That's the hope of both Viron and also of Yggdrasil, and hoping that Yggdrasil, Abmi, Zuckmoy do not realize that this is going to be a false, you know, a false trail that is being going, a false attempt. So Viron is showing, you know, greater plans than what can come up with Yggdrasil or Gratzt. All right. I'm going to start chapter 6. It is page 96, and it is the first paragraph. "Salam, stranger. May I have permission to enter your camp?" Ford had been aware of the nomad's approach for some time. He was but one of three riders who had walked their horses to a bowshot's distance, dropped the reins, and split into three. There was a warrior on either flank even now, just beyond the range of the firelight. The third was just inside the circle of illumination from the small blaze the young adventurer had kindled to cook the grouse he had brought down with his sling at twilight. Ford called back casually, "Of course you may come closer, and so can the two who lurk to either hand." The nomad laughed at that, for the Ormi, as he surely was from his accent, had not even bothered to look up from the fowl he was eating. "You must have the eyes and ears of a cat, stranger. Come, my brothers," he called to those beyond the light. "We have the hospitality of this one's fire." "I do not like those who creep up on lone wayfarers," Gord said as the fellow approached. "One must be cautious on the plains," the man replied with no hint of apology in his voice. "That is true, Akmani," the young thief said as he eyed the swarthy-featured man in the firelight. His striped robe of green and gray, the leatherwork of girdle and boots, and the big sword across his back identified the man as from the Achman tribes, which held the area north of the Yolspur Tors. The nomad seemed surprised that Gord knew his people. Does the fame of the Achmani stretch all the way to the Ormai kingdoms, then? "Robbers and muggers are recognized throughout the whole of Earth," Gord noted dryly. "And tell your brothers to stop skulking out there and come openly into my camp, or I'll have no choice but to kill you all here and now." "You are either a great warrior, Grey Eyes, or a stupid braggart," the Akmoni said. He looked Gord over, noting the sword and dagger he wore, and the lance that lay nearby. The small man's movements were smooth and precise. He used economy in all he did. His bearing was that of one who had no fear at all. "Come now, as I told you," he said to his comrades. "Our host is a paragon of warriors, and we will be safe camping here tonight." Gord stared at the nomad. The fellow seemed to admire Gord's casual demeanor and self-assurance in the face of three potential foemen. "I am called Gord," he said to the Akhmani. "Hail, Gord the Ormi. I am Eflam. These are my fellow warriors, Ukasin and Ushtur," he added as two similarly garbed and armed men came hesitatingly into the circle of soft firelight. "Be not shy, boys," Gord said without smiling. "Sit, all of you. There is but half the bird I roasted left, but you may have it if you hunger. With it you will eat of this bread and flavor it with my salt." The other two hesitated to accept the offering, but Eflam grinned and took a piece of the flat loaf Gord had produced. Akhmani smiled, sprinkled a pinch of salt atop it, and swallowed the piece in a gulp. "You too," he managed to say through a mouth crammed with bread. As Hukasin and Ushtur did the same, gobbling the stuff hungrily, Akhmani warriors swallowed, then grinned again and said admiringly to Gord, "So you know that my people honor the customs of those who dwell in the dry lands. You are indeed a most unusual man, even if you are an outlander. I like not calling you Gord. Oh, it has too foreign a sound for one so versed in the ways of the true folk. I will call you Farzul, our name for the gray striped cats who hunt the hills of Akhmanistan." All right. So, the Ulspur Tours. I'm dropping right here. We've a note on Drow. Oh, geez, what did I just do? We have a note on Drow.
How their magic abilities and cloaks and treasure degrade when they're away from the Underdark.
Yes, and before that, we have a little bit. Y'all is all barren plains or the dry steppes. And others, Sea of Dust, the clone spell. Yeah,
I was basically following up on everything that you had said, but I posted it in a different Discord.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, oh, why isn't he talking about it? But that's why.
Yeah. All right. And so we've got, the list of various treasures, the cloaks, the armor, the weapons. And yeah, it really is. It is pretty powerful stuff. I think it's the first time I may have seen +5 armor, +5 weaponry. And then we have this business. We have a listing of where Gastor is, which is wonderful because then we can place it. And like we know, why is the Ulspur Tours? Now, in that area where that 8 is, if you're seeing the text channel, we ran into earlier these Tuzmiti nomads. Back when Gord was in Ket and dealing with the Ketites and this dancing girl and this Tuzmiti nomad, it really turns out that Gygax has a very different version of Tuzmit than I've seen before. They're nomads in Tuzmit, but they're only seasonal. They have these seasonal dwelling places. Now, this 8 on the map is just north of the of what is all right, and it is the southernmost residence of these Tuzmiti nomads. And then, like an arc, they go up through what looks like from the Darlene map is Zyf, but actually it seems like it really is Tuzmit, and that the river is not the border. It's actually west of that river, between Tuzmit and Zyf. All right, so now, over a little bit to the Ulspur Tours, north of Yol, but still west of where Tuzmit is, we are now getting these people who are obviously Paynims. And, the true nomads of the deserts there. So So we have the plains of the Paynims, and up here at the Y at the top of the Tours, Gord is encountering some of these people. Now, with nomads, you're really not going to have strict borders. Most horse nomads, they, for the most part, they follow the herds. They live, they don't farm. They scavenge, you know, they hunt, but their primary living is off of herds of different kinds of cattle, mostly quick cattle like caribou and various things, elk and such. It's like up in the north of our world, the Sami, the reindeer people, live off of herds of reindeer. And they would not survive without them. Even though they have some other sources of food, if they did not have the reindeer herds, they would not be able to survive. So it just seems to me that either the Paynim, and this is possible, have a place where they go as a homeland. And that, I believe, is rumored. I've read these things that the Paynim, they actually, there's an area deep within their domain that was saved from the invoked devastation. So there's possibility that they are not just the simple nomads that they appear. But if they are nomadic, they're going to have to live off of some kind of, you know, either settlement or off of a herd. And in the terrible place, it's possible there are no herds. So, you know, so now that's who they've encountered. Gord has encountered Paynim, and he's getting, you know, a little explanation. We're getting a little detail on what the Paynim are like, and we have very little backlunish information. So Gord, the Gord book right here, starting to detail out this area of Kett and the southern part of Tuzmet, and now the Paynim and the Yol, who are the all, and we got just little bits and pieces right here. And so we have that they, you know, it is a custom that if somebody gives you bread and salt and meat, then, you know, like you are, that is your host, and as a guest, you are honored bound. And in really severe societies, there are a lot of these things where to violate that is to go against your whole culture. Very far up, the Norse used to have, they had to accept guests because it was such a terrible, during the winter, such a terrible lands up there that, you know, if you didn't accept guests, it, you know, it was very terrible. So we see here, all right, now all these names are changed. The Olspor, Kester, and Ol.
Might be Gaspor?
Yes, and no, Kester should be Ulican.
Ulican is the eight, I think.
That Ulican?
Yeah, I think so.
Right. Oh, you think that's the eight? I thought the eight was where... oh yeah, and three is Gastor. You're right. Gastor. Gastor. So we're going to see in that point there is an opening into the Underdark. I don't know if that's been noted. You know, we'll have to look, but just for us to make a note, that at the tip of the Old Sprue Mountains is Kestor and an entrance into the Underdark. So that's where Clavdra is going to pop up. All right, now we also have the name Farzul, and that is a gray-striped cat hunting the hills of Akhmanistan. All right.
Yeah, he's very perceptive in calling him a cat.
Yes, and right from the bit, he says you must have the eyes of a cat to see us in the dark, which he does. So,
yeah, so that goes back to a Saga of Old City theme of perception.
Yes, and honestly, we haven't all... Now, for Veron, we're seeing deception at work, but there has actually been much, much less deception in Artifact of Evil, and here in Sea of Death, the amount of deception and the ability to see discernment has been used minimally, I think.
Yeah, I guess that's part of like having evil characters is in the focus like they are.
I just think that there really needs to be a maturity factor, and super intelligence, very immature. Like Uz is practically like a six-year-old child. And he's fooled. I mean, it fools his intellect. And Grast is fooled by flattery from a beautiful drow. You know, it seems very, very strange. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 98 and the second paragraph down from the top. Gorge shrugged indifferently. Two other nomads clapped their hands and cried agreement. However, he sees and hears like a Farzul, said Ushtwer. That one is fierce as such hunters, Eflame. You name him well. And the four men settled down to conversation and a bit of bragging. When Gord mentioned the Alba Burr, all the Akmani scowled. These were hereditary enemies of their tribe, and Eflam, the brightest of the three and their natural leader, laughed. We Akmani are very perceptive too, he said. You are adopted by the Albabur, the tribes of the tiger, do you see? Gord shook his head. We have named you as a cat, Eflam exclaimed. The tiger folk have no merit in their adoption. I now make you a brother warrior of the Akmani. Barzul, all three then jumped up and pounded the young adventurer on the back. Gord, although he did not wish to belittle the privilege just bestowed upon him, could not help wondering why these tribes were so free with their pronouncements of brotherhood. First the Al-Babur, and now these Akmani. He was just about to say something to this effect when he found out what brotherhood meant in the Akmani sense of the word. You have nothing much to give us as presents for this honor, Ushtwer said, as he eyed Gord's fine stallion. The horse laid back its ears at the approach of the nomad, and then it snorted and bared its teeth. Ushtwer took a cautious step backward. Don't worry, brother, Hookson said to Ushtwer. Tomorrow we will find a caravan to plunder, or wild horses to capture. Then will our new brother, Farzul the Generous, bestow his gifts of appreciation upon us. I have a much better idea, Gord said loudly, to be sure he had the full attention of all three Akmani warriors. In gratitude for your generosity in making me a fellow warrior of your worthy tribe, I will give you all a lesson in the weapon play of my people. With that, the young man was on his feet, and his hands displayed long dagger and short sword. Not having seen him draw either blade, the nomads made signs against magic. There is no need for any gifts, brother, Eflam assured the small gray-eyed man, who stood poised before him. We have sufficient honor in sharing your food in camp, and counting you amongst the ranks of the men of Akmani. Both Huckason and Ushtwer seemed to agree very much with that statement. He stopped sweating when Gord put his weapons away and sat down again. Then they began sharing stories, and kept up until they settled down to spend the night around Gord's fire. All right, it's page 99. We're just about end of time, so I'm breaking right here. We get a little bit. Now, it's a little confusing. Now, the Al-Babur were definitely a tribe of the Tazmeti. So it's interesting that they're the tiger tribe. And that it makes more sense that they're the hereditary enemies of the Paynim. But again, I wonder about the link between the Tazmiti and the Tiger Nomads. And the Tiger Nomads were especially spelled out back in Artifact of Evil with Jakote, who was, killed in that book, but was a Tiger Nomad warrior, and joined with Curly Greenleaf, Geller, and Gord on their quest for the second artifact.
And I thought the tribe that Pearl and I forget the other guy's name were with were the Kirker.
Yes, they're Kirker. I'm not sure. They might also have been the Kirker might be a description. They might have also been Elbrati. They were definitely from Tuzmit. They were called Tuzmiti nomads. So, you know, again, we're going to have to re-examine some stuff to try to pin things down if we can, because Gygax is very general in a lot of things.
Yeah, that's usually a good thing.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's good to have a lot of questions. And it is, you know, I think that there is definitely an idea that the intellectual maturity of demons is the emotional maturity of demons is very low and a weakness to exploit, as, you know, is commented here. I think that is a factor. All right. Now, I unfortunately messed up last time. And somehow I either mistyped or something happened and Craig did not leave. And I thought I had, but there was some problem with recording 7 going on and Rich had to come in